The following podcast reflects the views and opinions of the hosts and guests only. They do not reflect the views or opinions of any agency or specific members of an association. At times, colorful language may be used and may be unsuitable for people under the age of 18. Discretion is advised. All right. Hello, everybody. Everyone that follows the PPA podcast, reintroduce myself. I'm Steve Graham, as president of the Las Vegas Police Protective Association. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for hitting us up on Spotify or YouTube, checking all these things out. We're now at, I think we're at 17 million with our last. Now we're 19 million people following. And I always, you all see me look up because we have a ticker rolling up there, a live ticker about how many people say we're 19 million. Today's show, we've got a circle back. We've got a follow-up. We've got our undersheriff, Andy Walsh, is on the show with us today. Andy, thanks for coming on, buddy.
Thanks for having me back.
Love having you back. Listen, the follow-ups on these things are always great. So we talked the beginning of you guys taking over at the department. Not taking over. You were already here. You were an assistant sheriff. But we talked about some things for the future, what kind of things you guys see changing, doing different. And so here's our recap. Where are we at? You know, what kind of things have you guys followed through? What's been tougher than you thought? What the job itself, you know, we were just talking off camera. A lot of people think they know what it takes to be successful in a position like this until they're in it, and then they realize maybe I don't have the chops for it. So, yeah, fill us in, man. How's everything been going?
Everything's been good. You know, it was interesting, you know, at the beginning of the year when, you know, we started this Sheriff McMahill's administration, you know, there's a lot of change, you know, a lot of things that take place. And, you know, you draw up charts and you put people in positions and then, you know, you go through some transition quickly. You know, people, Jim Seebach leaving in the first 6 months and causing another assistant sheriff promotion. I think candidly, you know, for starting with myself, there's, you know, whenever you go into a new position, anywhere on the organization, whether you go from patrol to narcotics or, you know, there's always a change and a learning curve. It's just, what I think the biggest shock to people is that transition from, say, captain of an area command or in a specialized unit, and then you get tapped to be a deputy chief. You know, the term I like to use all the time is the speed, complexity, and volume, of things that come at you in those positions. And I think in the beginning for me, especially the expectations that I had of some folks, you know, I'd temper a little bit of that, knowing that they are new in their positions and give them a chance to learn on the job, but try to still be a teacher and a mentor and have some patience. I'm not very patient when it comes to certain things.
The New York background.
But the lack of patience for me is, you know, a thing where, you know, we're always going, you know, you want to go. And to me, especially when it's things that affect, you know, line level troops and the things that the cops are out there doing every day, it's important for me that we get those right. And, you know, when there's if there isn't any urgency or direction or clarity on our part, you know, one thing we talk about frequently is like training days, for example. You know, when there's not a lot of clarity or people are confused about what's coming out of my mouth and what's coming out of the sheriff's mouth, that affects the guy out there doing the job and, you know, doing the actual real meat and potatoes work of policing. And so, yeah, it's really been a whirlwind and, you know, growing pains. And you know, so people are starting to figure out, you know, some things as far as what it really takes to be successful. And success really is, you know, that work ethic and the commitment, the sense of urgency, you know, figuring out what's important, what's not important, what they should spend their time on. We're coming through that part of this, I think, and we still got a lot of learning, all of us. I'm at the top of that list. I'll never stop learning. So, but it's been a whirlwind. One thing from the first podcast, too, Dan brought up was you know, the lack of things in the jail that seemed to get overturned. And knowing I was coming on here, I checked with Fred Haas, and he glowingly said, I overturned one yesterday. So it seems...
Great work, Fred.
Great
phenomenal
work, Fred.
Work,
I got
Fred.
One, yeah. So, but I know that that's important. Look, it's a key thing about being a leader, and that is an example, too, of a leadership quality that everybody has to have is listening, you know, and... that example that Dan brought up early on in the year was just we weren't listening to certain things or whatever it was to cause us to just always hold our ground on certain situations. And, you know, that's what I encourage Fred to do. Well, listen to what they're saying and see if there's a better way to do this. So I think people are getting more comfortable in their roles. Fred's doing a decent job at the jail. You know, the transition of Seabock leaving and then, you know, a couple chiefs coming, Carlos getting promoted, you know, after the first part of the year passes is we still have some, we're going to go through this type of organizational change. It's just the nature of the beast. And, you know, Kevin Skehan is retiring soon. So that's a guy that's been with this organization for 30 plus years and done a phenomenal job over there in digital investigation, you know, creates a void and a trickle down that, I think that we have to get used to, right? That's going to happen. And so for a lot of people, that turnover, that aspect of what it is they do as an executive is new to them. So you make plans, you draw up charts, and one guy retires or one lady retires, and now you're back at the drawing board. So it's been fun. Police work, no matter what I've done, has always been fun to me. This, you know, if I'm not laughing every day, or I go home every day with a little bit of a smile on my face because of how good we have it. But it's a whirlwind for sure.
Who, I'm going to put you on the spot for one person. What one person has really surprised you by how good of a leader or how well they're getting into a position? Could be at a chief level, captain level, lieutenant level. But as you are now, because you are the highest ranking police officer on the agency.
Yeah.
Kevin's not a cop.
So I can't say him?
No.
It's always good just to say the boss is the
best. No, it's not. No, because then it's kissing ass. But the truth is that, like, you are commissioned. He is not commissioned anymore. So you are the top commissioned. And so when you take that 10,000-foot view, because that's what you have to do, right? As an assistant sheriff, you have what is under you to look at. And so the other two assistant sheriffs have X amount. And so you're not necessarily watching what they've got. You got to focus on yours, because when you guys have your meetings, hey, Andy, under you, you've got X. What's going on with your folks? But now that you're above everybody,
right?
Who has surprised that you're like, man, that is really someone that I think is surprising. That is probably an up-and-comer that maybe even if it's not in your guys' tenure, that should be in a high level of rank, or maybe they're already there. But who would you think is that one person?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say one, because I really think that I really believe in my heart that we have so many exceptional people in positions. And I think one thing I have to say is that the dynamic of adding a chief administrative officer and James Kilber, I knew James a little bit before he came to Metro. But what James has done so far as the chief administrative officer, you know, taking a large chunk of the organization that the undersheriff in the past has typically had to deal with, and James being here for 5 years, you know, that's not an easy thing to do, you know, to elevate to a position like he has and take on that role and really has immersed himself in understanding what it is we do. You know, I always joke that, you know, you don't have to be crazy to work here. We train you. So I think we've gotten James trained up on what we do here, and he's immersed himself in a very short period of time. But the man's one quality about James is what he really cares about, you know, and he's been tasked with the Wellness Bureau and putting that together. But the one quality about him is when it comes to things and with his background working in the private sector and his connections in the medical field, how he's been able to just reach out across all lines when people need help and get people help. And I mean, we've helped a lot of officers in a lot of ways, and James is there. You know, James goes out in the middle of the night when he has to. James does a variety of things. And I can't really say I'm surprised by that, but that is one thing that was a dynamic change for the organization to have, you know, a chief administrative officer in the number three position, I guess, whatever you want to call it. But he that really has worked out phenomenally well. James, I think for James, it's people getting to know who he is and what his capabilities are and what his network exists, what that he has access to outside of Metro to help people when they need help, whether it's treatment programs for officers or their families, or, you know, he's got a background working for Comprehensive Cancer Centers in Nevada, which is unfortunately a phone call you never want to make. Hey, can you help us? We got an officer or a civilian employee that's struggling with this. I think James really has filled a role and you know, a job beyond his job, so to speak, with a lot of the things that he's accomplished. So I think for him, you know, I can name a few others. You know, when Fred Haas was made the chief of the jail.
Listen, I want to stop you, Andy, because you're giving me the which kid is your favorite child. I'm not going to directly answer. You started with a civilian who's not commissioned that. I'm not looking for the civilian folk. I'm looking for, who is my shining star? Listen, Fred Haas been a good dude. I've known Fred a long time. Yeah. Very good dude. If you told me, hey, he's a deputy chief, I wouldn't be shocked.
You know what's
going
to happen, Steve. I'm going to mention one guy and everyone else is going
to
walk
around. They're going to have to get over it. Listen, this is not everyone gets a participation award. Yeah. I want to know from the undersheriff who, hell, maybe one day you are the sheriff, says, you know what? This person really kind of came out of the woodworks to me that maybe I wasn't super aware of them. And boy, they're just a sharp, intelligent, good leader. And so don't
So
give me,
I can't continue to dance around?
No. You can do that with someone else. I'm going to sit here and just keep going. I'm waiting for the real answer.
Keep badgering me for one.
Yeah. Who is it?
Look, I was on my way to mentioning Fred, and one of the reasons I was going to say Fred was because, you know, he volunteered to take over the Clark County Detention Center. And, you know, it's always seems to me like that's, you know, an opportunity for folks to really learn about a large part of our organization. And in the past, we know when we've assigned people there from the patrol side, not the CO side, that, you know, it's frowned upon by some of the people within the detention facility. It looks like we're not providing opportunities. But, you know, for Fred to step up and, you know, say, hey, that's something I think I want to try to tackle, that says a lot about him as a person and as a leader. And but also, I what's never going to be said, but you know it from if you know Fred, is his motivation was really to do what he can to provide a sense of leadership and direction for the men and women that work there. And I think that that should not be lost on us. Fred has done a good job over there and just immersing himself and learning. And I was over there last week with him and walking around. I mean, it's like the guy's worked there for his entire career. He's talking to microphones. I don't exist. Doors are opening. He's proxying without looking. And, you know, so in a short period of time, he really has become a positive example of, hey, that's a tough job. You know, the jail is a tough place. He's stepped up and, you know, as an executive and really taken on that role and immersed himself in understanding what goes on there and what do those men and women need. There's a few people over there too. I think, you know, when we look at, so that would be, if you want one, you got Fred, but
now you're going to give me the, why your other kids are good too.
But you did ask though about lieutenants and captains and, you know, while I'm on the
I said I needed one. It can be a lieutenant. It can be a captain.
Okay.
I don't want to now
talk. I'll cut it off at Fred then.
There we go. Fred Hotch.
But I just be clear. I did start by saying we have exceptional leaders. I've been doing this a long time, Steve. I know how to dance around and answer. But you did put me on the spot. It is hard to pick.
And he's going to find a way to get the other people involved. Like, oh, and by the way, you know, this guy's doing really good. And this gal's doing a really good job. Yeah.
But yeah.
No, listen, it's important to, you know, not that, and like your children, like, you know, I've got four girls. You know, they're all special in their different ways, but, you know,
like you said, right? You talked about your 25-year hire date, right? And I started a month before you guys started. I mean, we were all in that locker room in Mojave. Some of us were police recruits, some of us cadets at the time, and you and Reggie and, you know, Smacka and a few others, right, that were in that group. And, you know, we've really grown up on the agency, you know, over the last 25 years. And we've all had an impact in some way, I think. And I think, though, that, you know, it's difficult to just pick one person because you're right. There is a fondness for the people that you grow up with on the organization that you see rise to levels and or take on assignments that have a tremendous amount of impact on the cops. Right, that's always been paramount for me. Is, you know, what how does this affect the people, you know, working the streets? And I think that Fred is a guy. You know, and there's, I won't name other names, but they're all doing a good job of putting
that. Go ahead and name
a few.
But
I think
more.
When you look at when they're making their decisions, you know, they're doing a good job of understanding. For me, a core thing is, how does it affect the cops?
Yeah.
Right? Is this good for the obviously, if it's good for the organization, but, you know, and how do we transmit what we talk about around a big table of people?
Sure.
How do we make sure what we want is getting to the people out there doing the work? And, They're all work. Their effort is there.
And I think I would have to agree with you on the Fred thing because Listen, everybody in every position of leadership is going to have issues, even with the PPA. We're going to not agree on everything. But to take someone out of a career that they knew a lot about, the police side, and then interject them into the correction side, it is a different animal. It is not car stops and investigations and things. It's a different thing, dealing with a different funding mechanism, dealing with the county, dealing with all kinds of different things. And so to be successful in an area like that, when you get kind of put into it, it does kind of separate you between, like, listen, if I'm a captain and I go to chief, sure, things are different, but I'm still dealing with police stuff.
Right.
It's just a bigger view. Whereas, hey, I'm going to take you and move you somewhere you've never been, other than booking maybe, well, I knew Fred as a cop, so he maybe booked someone at CCDC once a month.
Maybe.
And that was a 440 transport.
I had to show him where the jail was.
That was a warrant transport for a day shift guy when he was on swings. You know, but no, it does. That's tough. You did say something that, you know, it kind of ruffles some feathers at the jail that someone comes from the police side as a chief and goes in there. I can tell you from the troop side, they are always supportive of that.
Yeah.
They don't feel that chief has been poisoned by the things that go on in there, and they carry that through their career. And now that they're at that chief level, that they go, I know everything about you all, and I've already preconceived what I'm going to do, and I know the answers, and here you go. Someone from the outside comes in and goes, I don't know everything. I know how to lead. I know what we have to do, budgets, and I know all that stuff, but the working mechanism of it, I'm not jaded by anything. So I can come in with fresh eyes. And when Jim was the chief over the jail, Under Sheriff Dixon, when he was a chief over there, like, those were the best times for the corrections officers, because they had a fresh set of eyes over the place, and the other supervisors couldn't really get their way on treating people badly.
Right.
And that's really what it was all about for us, seeing a PO be promoted to chief and take that spot.
And Fred's smart, because you're right. You bring up some legacy name. Doug Gillespie was chief of the jail, went on to become sheriff. Bill Young, chief of the jail, went on to become sheriff. You know, Todd Fasulo, Charles Hank, all these folks that had that assignment in their career learned about parts of the organization. That's what I encourage people to, you know, young officers that test and promote, and then they immediately want to go back to where they were in a specialized unit. And, you know, that was the advice I was given early on when I promoted to sergeant, was go grow. And, you know, I get some jobs are just too much fun to resist, you know, and if that's your dream job, then I get over it. But I really like when people expand. And look, the jail is, like you said, there's so much to it, starting with the men and women that work there and the jobs that they do, and, you know, how violent booking can be at times. And, you know, you're dealing with a population of people that is, you know, they're incarcerated. Their freedoms have been taken away. Not an easy thing. But then you're right, there's complexities, like the, you know, I get emails when I was the assistant sheriff over the jail about the laundry system, for example. And you're like, well, what's wrong? You know, could start a riot. Like,
sure.
You know, so if you don't
food,
have people,
meals,
lice,
yeah.
all the things that our folks are exposed to, that you got to have someone that cares. And look, within the jail, I know that we have phenomenal captains. There's some really strong lieutenants that are over there that someday will be captains. And I think it's important too, because when people think of Metro, we have to make sure that our brothers and sisters that are working the decks of that facility and the North Valley complex and the people that are signing up for that job, they have to know that they're part of the family each and every chance I get. So
if you were, this just came to me, if you were the sheriff and you had a chief at the jail that was a corrections officer, could you ever see yourself promoting a corrections deputy chief to assistant sheriff?
And that's a great question, because that's part of the, at least in my mind, you know, you look at...
Because historically, chief is where it stopped for people at the jail,
the
right?
Funding mechanism
issues. You were done.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't see, Suey never promoted.
Right.
For, you know, it was, so the thought is, yeah, could you ever see someone at an AS level?
Right.
From that
then,
side.
Yeah, and I don't know. I'm not clear on how it would work from a finance or a budget perspective. I'm sure that would be something that the sheriff would have to work out with the county, because the jail is solely funded by the county. So the payrolls, the vehicle, everything. But I think that that's another reason, too, when, you know, we try to set people up for success. And I know from experience that there were several people that were deputy chiefs at the jail that before they retired, they reverted back to being a captain because the stress and the pace of that job wears on you.
When they wanted our insurance.
Well,
Clark County self-funded, they didn't want.
But the other piece of it is That's a hard.
He walked right through that one.
I don't know. Like, I'm sure. I know if I go to the pharmacy.
I remember those days with Joe when he wanted all of you guys going to Clark County self-funded, and people were like,
"Yeah, I think
is
that's
there any
I
way
have.
For us to stay?" I'm like, "Nope, your boss says no."
But I think it's, you know, when you look at, can someone go there and be the chief for 5-6 years? Mm-hmm. I think that's a lot to ask of a person. Yeah. So we have to consider that when we're putting people in there. So
that's interesting for you. So we talked about, you know, how as you advance, as you promote, things change. What's the biggest change from being an AS to being the
Yeah, I mean, I got nobody. Look, I think the biggest change is there's nobody left to ask.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that that's what chiefs are struggling with to some degree now. Assistant sheriffs struggle with in their growth is you're the decision maker now.
Yeah.
You know, when you're the cop, you can call the sergeant and go, hey, what do you think? And, oh, I don't know, let me call the lieutenant, right? I'm out of people to ask, right? There's nobody. I have to make a decision. And not that I'm worried about that, but that's the big thing I think for me is, you know, knowing and understanding the number of decisions that get made every day, but also being smart enough to drive home and go, that one might not have been the best one. Yeah. And then revisit the ones or listen to the feedback. That's the key is listening, you know, and that's what's great about our friendship, but the professional relationship as well is, you know, when you guys bring me issues, I don't think you can find one time where I didn't at least listen. I don't always change my mind, but you know, I think we do a good job of, I think once we stop listening or stop having dialogue, then that's where the problems break down. And for me, that's been the volume of things as well for me has been, it's amazing. Look, there's 6,000 people and the budget's over $1 billion. And, you know, and I sit in my office some days waiting for the door to open and have people come in and go, what are you doing here? You know, you don't belong here. So, you know, I deal with that mentally sometimes, I mean, did this really happen? Like, you know, like that realization sometimes is, and then trying to, you know, effectively still be a good father and a good husband, you know, that's important for me. My daughter just started high school and, you know, my wife being retired, you know, that's, you know, making sure that I'm not losing the connectivity with them. You know, that's most important. That's what's going to be here long after I decide to retire is my family. And that's paramount for me. So, but I encourage that of my people too, is make sure you're spending time and doing the things you can with your family and, you know, take the vacations, turn the phone off when you need to. Got enough people now at the executive level where if you need someone to cover for you so you can go do those things, so you can go to a movie, so you can go have dinner and you can go on a vacation, that then we have to make sure. And I think that's what's difficult for people is that as well. Encouraging that, I think it becomes is really important, but it's hard for people to do. You know, they like what they do. I think the volume, though, is just the difference between what I dealt with as an assistant sheriff and what I'm dealing with as the undersheriff. The volume of those things, it's just I can't really describe it to people. Reggie asked me that the other day. What's the difference? I said, I was kind of speechless. I'm like, I can't even begin to tell you, you know. Yeah. But I think I think when you – all along I've been – taught, you know, make a decision, and expanding on that thought is not just telling people how to make a decision, but walking them through how to make a decision and what to base that on. You know, is it good for the officers? Is it good for the department? Does it feel good with what you stand for in your position? And then you're probably making the right decision. But you got to be comfortable that you're going to make some wrong ones.
Yeah.
And look, some of the ones that we make that are wrong or that we look back on and go, oh, we could have done that better. You got to be honest about it. You got to look in I just read an article the other day that talks about the ugly mirror. You know, if the mirror is telling you all the time you're the fairest one of all, then the mirror is lying.
Yeah.
You know, none of us are perfect. So, and the mirror has never told me that anyway. God knows. But the point is you can't read your press clippings.
Yeah.
You know, you got to take some stock of yourself and be candid and go, yeah, I probably could have listened a little better on that. And I think that's another struggle too. It goes back to the earlier question, right? Is it okay to be wrong? You know, with wellness, we always say it's okay not to be okay, but you know, you got made deputy chief, you got made assistant sheriff, you got made the undersheriff. It didn't make me any smarter.
Yeah.
You know, I know how I got there, but that didn't make me any smarter. So there'll be flaws for sure. And it's okay to have flaws.
It's funny. I was, as you were talking, it made me think, on Facebook, there's a are you on Facebook?
No.
Okay. It's Facebook is this social media platform.
Yeah.
And you can get on it. But it doesn't run through AOL with the little guy running.
I still have an AOL email address that's for my awesome. Private account.
So do yeah. I. I use that for like...
Dory asked me one day if I was still in high school.
Discounts for like different places because you got to set up 50 different emails so you can get free shit. But so it was on Facebook. It was it's a round table and the focal point of the round table is Tom Hanks and it's a black and white video. And it talks about, he keeps saying, this too shall pass.
Right.
Right. And he's talking about, you know, the bad times. And he's like, hey, this too shall pass. And then he gets on, he goes, feeling high on the horse, feeling like everybody's on your side, this too shall pass.
Oh, yeah.
And that's, you know, people think, you know, hey, man, everything's going great. And everyone loves me until the next thing happens. And all of a sudden, you are not the person we love.
Yeah, I had that experience, you know, like, I get that experience sometimes, like, you know, I like listening to music in the car on the way to work, sometimes a little too loud.
What are you listening to?
I get satellite radio on my phone. I listen to the
Simply Sinatra?
There's a classic Rewind channel, on, and they always play good, like, 80s, 70s, 80s music. Sometimes U2, sometimes I listen to the Springsteen channel, but Springsteen from being on the East Coast, and I've always loved his music, but... the classic Rewind and Lithium every once in a while. I get the Lithium channel, so if a little Nirvana or something comes on, I go through these stages with the Ozzy's Boneyard, you know, where I bang my head off the steering wheel. I come in a little dizzy, rattled, but I don't know where I was going with all that, but the music part.
It's all the head banging. That's why you
came. Yeah. So the... But we were talking about...
You're driving into work, you're listening to some
music. Yeah, so you get this feeling of like, I got it all figured out. You know, yesterday was great. I think I'm doing good. And then, a landmine goes off and, you know, you're scrambling. And that's another aspect of the job, too, is, you know, I have a schedule every day that's pretty full. And what I try to build in there is a little time for the grease fires, you know. You got to have time for the grease fires. And if you don't, then the grease fires burn the whole restaurant down, lack of a better term. So you got to be careful of just packing your schedule with too much. You got to have a little time to manage by walking around and, you know, us going out and doing the ride-alongs and, you know, me taking trips to places to see things and over to jail last week. And, you know, you got to find the time to do that. But, yeah, when you think you got it all figured out, oh, man, that's the danger zone. Whenever I feel comfortable like that, I start to get nervous because I've known from experience. I had an experience one time when I was the captain downtown, and I used to park, you know, come in off of Bonanza. So I was like sitting at the turn lane there, music blasting in the car, pulling into the substation parking lot, just feeling high on the hog. You know, everything's going good, crime's down, pulling the parking lot. There's three people waiting for me at my parking space. Hey, we just had a triple murder or whatever. I'm like, oh my God. And I thought today was going to be a good day. And, yeah, you got to constantly be on edge, for sure.
So now you and I were talking, one of the really cool things, and I don't know if you had experienced it before, was going back to D.C. for Police Week and being there for our Top Cops dinner with NAPO and seeing Tierney getting recognized and things like that. So, you know, how was that for you guys, you know?
Yeah, it's the first time that in between New York and here now, I've been a cop 31 years, and a lot of names on that wall. Of people that I knew, worked with, a couple guys I went to the police academy with in New York, a guy named Kevin Gillespie and a kid named Sean McDonald that were killed in the line of duty, and, you know, obviously all the folks here, and very emotional, you know, when you get down to that monument and that memorial, and, you know, you see it, and I was there for when the Police Unity Tour arrived, and you just see this wave of bikes coming in and the crowds and the appreciation of that, you know, with all the rhetoric that's been out there the last couple of years, and that rhetoric sometimes is louder during post-event things, and it's existed my entire career where there's been this anti-police rhetoric. To feel like, see all that and see that appreciation, you know, from the number of people that showed up just at that event. You know, I'm not ashamed to admit how many times, you know, I found myself wiping tears from my eyes just during that week and during the time that we spent there. And, you know, the precursor to D.C. was going up to Carson City and going up north for ceremonies up there. But D.C. was unlike any other experience I had. And I appreciated you having us at the table for the Top Cop Awards. And, you know, that to me was incredible just to see in our profession the people that we recognized and honored for the things that they had done and, you know, and then you see this you know, these young officers get up when they get their award, and then there's a microphone up there for them, and they just play this horrific video of people losing their partners, and you know, and then these kids get up to the microphone, and I call them kids, but they're cops, right? But I'm 55 now, so I guess they're kids to me. But they get up to the microphone and they tell this incredible summary and thankful and their gratitude for people that are there. I called Janine from the dinner. I stepped out a few times and I called her and said, I'm bawling at the table, you know, like, and, you know, seeing Tierney get honored. And it was a reminder for me of the other folks, you know, that what they were involved in didn't rise to that, but they shouldn't be forgotten, right? And then Officer Santos from traffic is one that I was reminded of after we returned that, you know, here's a guy, he got hit by a drunk driver just out there riding that motorcycle. And, you know, he's got a lot of long path ahead of him till, you know, he still has, I can't count the number of surgeries he told me he had, but, you know, he's got that is a reminder for us too, that whole thing and the candlelight vigil for me was important, you know, and being there with the sheriff, he was there for, you know, we both went and, you know, seeing the names read off, you know, being able to be there with the families of the names in the crowd was important. We can never let them think we forgot. And for us, you know, we never forget, but for them it's different because the phone stops ringing. You know, they don't have interaction with Metro every day. So I think it was important for us to be there, and I was grateful that the sheriff made that happen. It was great. That Top Cops dinner, though, I mean, that to me was unbelievable. Best part of the experience, as gut-wrenching as it was, and just amazing to me what young men and women in our profession do on a regular basis.
Yeah, they do a really good job, and, you know, there's submissions across the country, but... And then to what you said, there's acts of heroism that maybe don't rise to the level of what we saw, right?
Because he only picked 10, right?
There's only 10, yeah. But there's so many. You know, Brian's a part of the process, looking and vetting. And I'll say this, one thing I did not like about the candlelight vigil, and I've gone, gosh, I've been there maybe 9 years now. The fact that our sheriff is there, I wanted to see our sheriff read the names of our fallen. It's important, especially if the sheriff's going to take the time to fly back and say, hey, I'm going to get in my uniform. I'm here. I'm ready to go, right? And then someone says, oh, no, we don't have it in the program for that. That's bullshit. Like, it's not your officer that was lost. It's ours.
Yeah.
If we are going to send a representative, that person should be reading the names. And that's something, you know, if anyone with the cops group or whomever follows or watches this, that needs to change.
Yeah.
If a representative, especially a high-ranking representative, if he can't go and you're there, you should be reading those names.
Right.
I don't want to hear from someone from another state. I don't want to hear from a senator from our state. I want to hear from the leader of the organizations to say, hey, these were my people, and I'm going to memorialize their name for the last time.
Yeah, we put names on that wall, and, you know, I know that it hurt the sheriff, you know, to not be able to do that. I have my own feelings. I'll be very candid. I thought it was insulting, especially when the chief that got up and read the names couldn't pronounce the name of our state correctly and couldn't pronounce an officer's name correctly. It just, to me, I don't know. Corporate events, to me, when it comes to honoring cops, those things are in conflict.
Yeah.
And I think an unintended consequence of that was that gave us more time with the families. That gave us more time to be out in the audience with the families that were there to be honored. And I am in 100% agreement with you that that was a tough pill to swallow to not see Kevin be able to read those names. And, you know, I think the families understood, and I think they were grateful for us to be in the audience with them. But in the future, that should never happen again.
I'm literally out in the crowd when they're reading, and I'm told my wife, I said, hey, get the phone ready. Let's record Kevin doing the names. And
it's from D.C.
I'm looking.
Chief from D.C.
I'm looking at the bodies standing behind, and I know we're about to hit Nevada, and I don't see them.
Right.
And I'm saying that to my folks on the board. I'm like, where the hell's Kevin?
Yeah.
And then when it doesn't get read, I lost. I mean, because I knew he was there. I knew you guys were there. I knew he was going to do that. And then later when I found out how that whole bull crap went down about timing and all this, like, listen, the family, like you said, it was good that you guys got to spend time with the family. They want to hear their sheriff
right.
read the name of their loved one for the last time, because it's not every year.
Right.
That was it. That was the one shot that those folks were going to have their boss, the leader for their lost husband, read the name.
Yeah.
And someone else said, "Ah, we've already got a program set, so this is how it's going to go."
Right. Yeah, it wasn't arranged in advance. That's should have done this or should have done that. And
yeah, that one irked me a lot. And I know it wasn't Kevin's fault. I hit him up immediately. There, I go, "Where are you?" And he said they wouldn't let me do it.
It was painful.
And so him and I talked. And to those that may wonder, it was not his choice. He was there. He was ready to go. And they did not allow him to do it. So again, food for thought for whoever may watch this. If you're a part of that process, you need to do better. You need to let the agency head.
Well, on top of that, too, we had two guys from our honor guard, Ryan Wiggins, and I'm going to forget the other guy's name, so I'll be getting that hate mail. But they played the taps. They played taps. The two, I think there's a name for it, where you have two trumpets going at the same time. But they did that, so we recognize our organization for that. But that was tough. That was definitely. But I go back to the positive part of it was just the outpouring of support from the community that was there. It was a good event. We need more things like
that. Was it your first time?
First time I'd ever been there.
So seeing that sea of people all the way out almost to the Washington Monument from where we're at, you know, going back to the west, it's really cool to see that many people in the monument or the mall, the outdoor mall.
Yeah, that to me has been, I'd been to D.C. before for work-related stuff and never had a chance to, move around and see stuff. So I had a little time to do that with Kevin, who's spent time there in the past. So we got to see some of the historical things that, I spent a little time. We rented scooters, believe it or not. We were zipping around.
Those are awesome.
It was fun.
Best way to get around.
Best way to get around. And, but that was good to do and, see the different memorials and, just the history there. But the event itself, man, you're right, just to see all those people there. And I think, one thing we were talking about earlier was training, what's scary or what's, sad, I guess, in a way, was certain states where, and I get some states are bigger than others, right? But certain states, just reading off the number of names of officers they lose, and it's fairly consistent that I'm grateful that for as a state and as an organization that, we've been as fortunate as we have been, even though the losses we've experienced hurt. We've been very fortunate.
So knowing how many people were in that thing, you were at the memorial, the actual memorial. Can you ever imagine we used to do it there?
Yeah, no, there's no way. Like, the guys were telling me that, I'm like, that's
standing
amazing.
Standing on hills, standing on trees.
You can't even get people in there for the bike right now.
Yeah. You packed everyone packed in there. And it used to be cool because they would take a blue laser and it would light it up across the middle of the monument over everyone's head. And it would go on for a mile. It was really cool. They couldn't get, I don't think they can get the approval to do that toward the monument because I think they probably think someone's going to blow up the monument.
The bagpipes, though, the music. Yeah. Everywhere you went, there was bagpipe music, right?
The event is very well done. Yeah. And I'm not trying to knock whoever, I think it's the cops group that runs it. Having the TVs, having the speakers, it's a great setup. Yeah. But, peer reviews for everything we do is important. And there's one thing that you need to change, which is...
Yeah, you shouldn't have a sitting sheriff or a sitting chief not be allowed because of, who's on your board.
Yeah, and even conversely, let's say someone from the that lost their loved one absolutely hated the leader. Then maybe the leader shouldn't do it, right? Because it is about the family. But without that, the family wants to hear from their leadership.
Yeah.
And they want to hear them say their employee's name, their loved one's name, for the final time in respect. And that shouldn't have happened. And that was kind of tacky, in my opinion. Super tacky.
Totally agree.
all right. So one other thing we want to talk about is the training. You and I were talking about training. You've alluded to training a few times. We've had but we've had consistently different folks call us and say, hey, they're telling us we're not getting training. We're not doing training. And we've talked at great length about how important the training is. And what we've tried to structure that training to be. And I know we kind of had a fairly good agreement. It was an email about, you know, listen, you'll have one training day that for sure is a guaranteed training day. Of course, nothing is guaranteed. The world falls apart. We need people. It is what it is. But it was never meant to take away, hey, we just got high calls for service.
Right.
Then that second one was a little bit more fluid. If the squad members and the squad said, hey, we're going to go out and do a DPA, we're going to go do something. But it's not, it wasn't intended to be, well, our DPA is go handle calls for service and go do hotspot enforcement. It still was supposed to have some training component. And that one was the, you know, it's funny too, and, you know, the folk people know that. When I thought I was retiring, I haven't done a single thing at UMLV.
Oh, you're behind now.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I'm so nervous for all the UMLV I have waiting. Like, it's like...
You'll do it in December like everybody
else. It's like being afraid to go to the doctor. Like, I don't want to know what's wrong with me. I don't want to see... The guys up here go, Steve, have you opened it up? I go,
hey, speaking of the doctor, though, that was another thing. Can I talk about
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Listen, guys have to go to their physicals.
Oh, that's right. Oh, this is so aggravating, guys.
You guys got to go to your physicals.
When we say guys, we mean our men and women.
The truth, the men and women.
We know it's just a generalized term.
Yeah, but men and women, ladies and gentlemen, please go to your physical. You know, there's a case right now that's out there in litigation that for an officer who passed due to heart disease. I think he had a heart attack. But it's easy for people that get involved in that to deny claims that would normally be covered by the heart and lung bill if you don't go to your physical. And, you know, we're dealing with a case now where an officer hadn't gone to his physical for several years and then had a heart attack. And it's an uphill battle for your family if that were to happen to you. And I get all the emails now. I've been asked, which was a mistake. I asked to be included on all the emails that I started a process through health and safety where, hey, send an email to the supervisor, the captain, include me on it. And I got about 500 of those the other day of people that hadn't taken their physicals. Some hadn't taken their physicals in multiple years. That physical is not for me. That physical is not for the department. That physical is for you. So is it the best? No. Are we working to change that through health and safety and wellness and yes, but, you know, and I know the dynamic, too. It's a lot of young officers, both men and women, who feel like, what's going to happen to me? You know, and I've been there. I know what it's like to feel like you're invincible. But you have to do it because if you don't and something happens, you're leaving the ones that care about you behind in a little bit of a bind and certain benefits that have been fought for, certain benefits that have had to be passed enacted through law. You're foregoing your rights to those things, and there's a reason that those things exist. So, and a few people that hadn't gone to their physical or for a couple of years, those are the ones I'm strategically responding to. And I think I sent somebody out there. Are you kidding me? You know, you can't, yeah. Like, you know, and if there's an issue where you can't go or your boss is telling you not to go, just like we're going to talk about with training, you call me directly if someone tells you you can't go. We've got some folks that have been on extended leave or FMLA. Those I understand, but at least as soon as you come back from those things, if you're not in the workplace, get that physical scheduled. Please. I can't tell you enough. And while we're at that topic, too, another thing that comes up randomly from time to time is make sure your beneficiary information on everything that has a beneficiary is up to date and accurate, because that's another one that seems to rear its head from time to time. So but please take your physicals.
Andy and I were talking about that, and I said, I'll call these people because to what you just said, you're potentially foregoing your benefit. I hired on this job at 18 years old. I have not missed a physical, not once.
It's not that
hard.
It
was a part of my process. Like I knew,
right.
And I'll tell you this, like we had when Fasulo was here, Fasulo took an opposite stance. If you miss it, good. You couldn't go back and do it. If it was outside of those 3 months, you're done. You don't get a shot at it. And we were fighting to say, you can't do that. Like, first of all, in NRS, the physical is guaranteed. You have to do it. But now we've got a group that's like, guys and gals, go get it done.
Right.
If you think it's the worst physical in the world, who cares? Right. Listen, we still know they check your blood work. They give you the blood results. I take my results and I take them to my doctor. Hey, doc, is there anything they're missing? I can tell you my mother was a heart care nurse, God rest her soul, when she was alive. She always felt the Metro physical, and this was a lady that was in the medical field for a long time, 30-something years, said this is one of the best physicals that's done in this state. And she's seen them all over the place. They do a very thorough panel. Could there be more? Yeah, sure. I think more I'd like to see, from my perspective, I'd like to see us doing a PSA test at a certain age. I'd like to see us maybe at, I don't know, 45, do an echocardiogram. Maybe adds a little money, but gives us a little bit more look into some of the things that the EKG may not catch.
Right.
But I would never say don't do it. And so, yeah, I told you, I said, let me talk to these folks, because I would make them feel like crap for saying, why didn't you go?
Yeah.
Like, it's a necessary evil.
To be young again, too. These kids eat like whatever they want. No doubt. And shoving food in their mouth, and the pace of the job, and the hours and the tempo, they feel invincible. And I understand that.
When you and I talked, there was an officer, I won't mention his name, but it caught blood cancer when they did his blood draw. Was not, it had never happened before. And still to this day, he's being treated. But thank God he had it caught. Because if, like you say, you go 5 years, you know how much bad crap can happen to your body on the inside in 5 years?
Sure.
Right?
Especially as we get older. Stress, right?
Yeah. It can happen like that, you know. So if you're not taking care of yourself, you're not getting screened. It's a free test. Go get the physical done, please, please, please.
And the crackers and the peanut butter down there are second.
Yeah, the best apple juices and orange juices you can get out of a fridge, you know. And listen, it's even to the point now. Like, we have our own separate side. So folks that are like, oh, it's easy. I don't want to. We go in a back door. It's a great process, you know.
Look,
and for the patrol officer, what did we like about it? Got me off the streets for about 2 or 3 hours a day.
Look, and I was cop in New York, like everybody knows, and I never got a physical when I was there. I could have cared less.
Yeah. No, it's you're right. I'm glad you picked that up and covered it, because, gosh, you guys stay on top of that stuff and follow up with your own doctors. And we have good insurance. Speaking of James Kilber, that guy has been amazing. We've had, unfortunately, officers that have had cancer, and you make a phone call to James Kilber, and James Kilber is getting someone into a specialist immediately when they're told, hey, we don't have anything open for 3 months.
Yeah, we had one person that was told, find a sunny beach.
Yeah.
And James got him into MD Anderson in Houston.
Houston, right?
Yeah. And they're still here.
Yeah.
And they're back to work, full duty. Incredible story. Hey, you're going to die. No, you're not. We just need to get you over here. Could you imagine?
Sure.
Yeah,
crazy.
We're talking about training days, though.
So I want to try and get some clarification. Me and you talking, people can watch this. Now we're at, 20, we just passed 20 million. 20 million people following the PPA podcast. The training is designed. We are training on the agency, correct?
Yes.
You're training twice a month.
I don't remember. Whatever it was we had worked out, it's been so long that I felt like it was done. But to find out that, like, we're still, look, we all agree, like, and that's the thing too, is, when I encourage folks that want to change up the schedule of the training days, you know, and then I hear from you and I said, well, did they explain it? And he's no. And then I'll make a phone call, find out what the reasoning was. And you go, why didn't they just tell us that? So there's always an understanding of what can cause training to be canceled. Right. And the training is so important. And so hear it from me. What that agreement is, you know, the twice a month, we've asked people to make sure they have a comprehensive, from the captain level and down, you know, have a comprehensive understanding of what your folks are doing. Make sure it fits in with what is going on currently in the world. And, you know, it's not the old days where, you know, long breakfast or lunch and maybe a little paintball, catch a movie, you know. If you wanted to do that, you missed it. That era is gone. It's not coming back. No, I'm not bringing it back.
What did we use? It was under the guise of active shooter training,
shooter training.
Paintball and laser tag was active shooter training.
Me, Pat Ledbetter, Michael Hawk. Oh, my God. The fun we had with Steve Stubbs. But
did you guys ever go to that, what was it, on like the north end of town off like Grand Teton?
No, we went to the one. It was at Vegas in Decatur in that old shopping
center. Oh, okay.
There. That old building in there that was a paintball. Anyway, you know... Again, coming from another agency where we never trained, to be able to go do that was like, but now it's got some formalized structure to it, and we want it documented so we can, you know, show what we're doing and help people understand. You go to other places and, you know, they don't train. I talk to other executives and, you know, they don't provide what we provide. We have the, you know, reality-based training facility, the Jetty, you know, all the places that we can take advantage of. So we want our folks to train. And it goes hand in hand to me with, you know, the awareness reports that come out, you know, the CERT reviews that we do, the use of force review board, the tactical review board. There's always things that come up in those things that can be corrected through training. And if we're not training, I don't know how we expect our cops to get better. And when, like, our last officer-involved shooting that we had, you know, we have a bunch of officers that clearly, we had officers from different area commands outside this house. And you have a lady in there, it's a potential hostage situation, bad guy's armed with a knife. They hear screaming. They assemble, stack, boom, in, problem solved, right? That doesn't happen if we're not training,
yeah.
Right? Working together, coordinated. Yeah, does it get a little messy, a little, you know, the stacks dissipate sometimes?
Sure, sure.
Then we don't think, they're not SEAL Team 6, so when those things happen, we understand why they happen, right? We had to go into a house, kick in a door, and shoot a guy who's holding a hostage, screaming at knife point, right? I mean, a terrible thing for any of our officers to ever have to be involved in, but they're not going to have the confidence to go do what they did in that video without training, right? And so to hear that we're not hitting the mark with, and by the way, if you come to me, if I was the lieutenant, you go, hey, we have no plan for training, then that's going to be my answer. Well, then you're not training. You know, these are things that we've encouraged the sergeants, the lieutenants, the captains, just what is going on? That what is the deficiency that you can correct? What is the, you know, the it could be pat downs. It could be a variety of things that you do that just satisfy a need that we have to make sure our cops are safe. I mean, that's the whole point, right?
Well, and coming out of from our perspective, of course, like with the use of force boards, we've seen many times you got a cop that's on the job for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. And the only reference material for them to say you've been trained was your academy.
Yeah, or that's, a lesson plan.
That's not good enough.
Right.
To say you were taught this in the academy. Yeah, you're right, but everything's a perishable skill. The academy that we get, and I wrote an article about it. I said, listen, we get phenomenal training for 6 months in that police academy. And then that goes by the wayside for calls for service.
Sure.
And we forget that we've got to the continuing education in the legal field, medical field. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
It has to keep going. And I think, too, and we were a proponent for, yeah, it needs to be structured. It doesn't need to be like you and I used to do. There should be a training coordinator at every area command saying, listen, this week, here is what's on the docket.
Right.
Because I think it's smart, because now me working Northwest, if I get assembled and I got to go to Southeast to help with something, or if I just left jail and something's going on in downtown, I know I can jump in a stack, and we all just did this same thing. I think having some uniformity to what we're showing the folks, so that if an incident happens, you can say, hey, I know you were in Northwest, but last week your training was X, correct? Yes. And they did the same thing, correct? Yes. Okay, so then you guys should have been able to marry together.
Yeah.
And that's important, because we've seen that happens all the time. You know, in a box squad, we just need a surge. We need people in places. But we don't want to have a group that has a guy like Sal Mascoli that's training people every day, who I still don't think Sal works here anymore. I think he retired 5 years ago. He just keeps coming back. You guys are afraid to take his proxy card, and he deals out drinks to every
year. He shows up.
That's it. Yeah. He's got 2 wristbands
on. He still
on,
works here, yeah.
And I don't even think he gets paid. Yeah. I think he gets a purse check. But so that guy's doing that, and they're getting training, and then you go to Northeast, and they're like, we haven't trained in, because right. We always have calls for service. We have hot spots. And I agree with you, the theory of, well, hey, we have nothing to do. Well, first of all, there's always something to do.
Right.
As I'm going to find
if you're
out,
that bad,
right. I'm going to find out in December that there's something to do when I open my UMLV file. Right. That stuff takes time, right? We got classes that they're an hour, 2 hours long.
The CJIS research.
You guys in executive staff,
NCIC,
you screwed us. We can't fast forward anymore. We can't jump ahead.
Yeah, I frown at that decision too. I
right? Or sometimes it'll just throw you back to the start.
Well, how about when you get a question wrong? You're like, how did I get that wrong?
but so there is always something to do.
Right. And yeah, you can have a look at the beginning of the year. You just create a comprehensive plan, and it's a plan, right? And planning is essential, you know. But plans sometimes have to go by the wayside. And look, you can have that structure. And I think that there's enough. Look, there's so many platforms out there. Take this last event we're talking about, right? When these officers make this decision to make entry, right? You can put a squad. You can go up to the range. You can go to the Jedi, right? We have doors now. Remember, we had one door that we stole from the fire department to practice ramming on. Now they got more doors than they know what to do with, right? So that was it. That was what if they couldn't get to the door? Where was the tactical view? Like, how would your squad have handled that? That's what I would encourage. How would you guys have handled? You could do that on a dry erase board in the classroom, and then go out and practice, right? And you as the sergeant, you know, look, there are certain people you want on the ram and certain people you wouldn't want on the ram. just not strong enough to break a door down, right? But if you got a beast and you want to hand them, that's how does he drive the tactical vehicle? All these little things are scenarios. I'd run if I was a patrol sergeant right now and I saw that video, we'd be our next training day, we'd be up at the range figuring out a way to go, okay, we're out here, here's how we're going to handle this. Get your squad to think like you as the sergeant, right? Hey, here's what I'm thinking of. This is what I'm doing. This is why I'm on the phone. I'm calling SWAT. I'm doing this. This is why I have you guys positioned that way. Then they get in this house, though, in a perfect, you know, world. They kick the door. It would open, but bad guy either put his weight behind it or put something behind it. Okay, there you go. What's the tactical plan, right? Do you have somebody outside? If she's screaming and she's being injured by the suspect, right? Do you start breaking windows? What are the things that you can do in that situation? Because life safety is the paramount thing. So I just came up with a training scenario everybody's probably going to go do, but that's something you can do, right? It's just take what's going on in the world and go practice it.
But that's good, right? I mean,
that's the whole purpose of the time, right?
It's not like, hey, someone's going to steal Andy's idea. That's the point.
Right.
The point is to say, hey, let's find something that we can all do. Listen, briefing rooms are different than they were back when we started. It's so funny to talk about back when we started. But we used to
have debrief everything.
We would stay. The shift would be over. Now, I'm not advocating that people stay because they have to get paid overtime. I'm saying we did it on our own.
Yeah.
But we stayed graveyard. We stayed till 9 in the morning talking about a call, talking about a thought process, talking about a legal issue. We would have those conversations. And so looking at a model for training, you can't tell me if I'm a sergeant in 2 weeks – I can't find one of the calls we had and say, hey, this is what we're going to work on our training day.
Right.
Hey, even if it worked out properly, let's assume, like you just said, hey, we banged the door open. Okay, what if it didn't?
Right, change the scenario.
We're all stacked up, right? Or we hit that door and right inside there's more fortification. And now the whole team can't make entry. What are we doing?
Right.
You know, and so I do think it's just people just got to take the time. And I do think it falls on the sergeants to say, yeah, what do we got? Right. I should know either tomorrow's briefing or tonight's debriefing or from being out on the shift, some things that we had happen. And so now I'm going to take those and I'm going to throw us in a situation. I may talk to Sal. I may talk to my DTIs. I may talk to my tactical people. I may call SWAT. Hey, here's what we had. What kind of training could I do with that? And so that we're doing something meaningful, not just trying to put something together. But this theory of folks just saying, hey, we're going to go out and hit hotspots. That's our DPA. That's bullshit.
Yeah. I mean, our first priority, obviously, is the crime and managing the crime. But, look, no one – what's the point if our cops aren't safe? And that's the whole goal of the training. It has to be meaningful. But you're right. I mean, in a two-week period, if there hasn't been a foot pursuit, if there hasn't been something that you
can
go and train, setting up a perimeter, right, or get the canine guy to show up and say, hey, how would we do this? Or, you know, you can always find something to do that's meaningful. And by the way, you can do the same thing multiple times. Like you said, we had this conversation the other day about stuff that people are taught in the academy that is important, but we probably should give it to them a month after they graduate. It's like incident command system classes for sergeants, lieutenants, captains, or whatever. You go sit through it, and then you don't do it for 6 months. And then the first time someone says, hey, draw me, you handle this, it's a foreign language.
For sure.
You know? And they're not comfortable with doing it. So there has to be repetition. So it can be the same thing over and over again. Put people in different roles. Okay, on this one, you're low lethal. On this one, you're the 40, right? I had a tactical vehicle inspection done one day. I think I forget where I was. I went out to an area command. I said, hey, show me the TAC vehicle. And there's four coolers and, you know, garbage in the back of the truck. And I'm like, oh, how would you get the 40 out? You know? And they're like,
it's in the cooler.
It's in the cooler, right?
So different 40.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, sir. You wanted that one.
But you know, I mean, like little things like that, the inspect what you expect model is important. And so just, hey, we did that one time. Chris Jones and I were working together as chiefs, and I think it was during the marathon, and knowing that how many streets are closed or whatever, and we had given out notice that we wanted everybody prepared because the marathon's a big deal.
Yeah.
And as a preparedness exercise, we told everybody, hey, make sure your PD, everybody's in uniform, because if something bad happens, that's the first wave. Whatever's working is going to be the first wave. So we, about an hour or two into the marathon, we called all the admin lieutenants and said, hey, have three guys and a sergeant from PD come to headquarters dressed, ready, in uniform with all their equipment. I think I'm still waiting for some folks to show up. Guys showed up, no uniform shirts. They're in t-shirts and, you know, no gas masks, no helmets, right? And it was nobody got in trouble over it, but it was a
preparedness for sure, right?
So you can do that as a sergeant.
Yeah.
Hey, I used to do that as a graveyard lieutenant at DTEC. Hey, let's do a mobilization. You know, if we had an active shooter right now at Binion's, right? I got four people at the jail. So who's coming? Who's handling this? And get people used to the mindset, okay, it's going to be the three of us. That's it. That's what's here, right? So I think you can do those things all day long, and you're never going to hear a complaint out of me. Because what do cops always say too, right? How many interviews have you been in on? How many times have we heard people say, well, I reverted back to my training.
Mm-hmm.
I learned this in training, right? I'm alive because of training.
Sure.
That drives me nuts when we have to have that conversation. So
2 training days a month, unless something bad's going on, right?
Yeah.
And we agree a DPA is not go out and handle calls.
And
for
think
service.
About where we've come from, right?
Because that's what we keep getting.
Yeah.
Hey, we get to say what a DPA is, and a DPA is go handle calls for service.
Yeah. Well, then it's not training.
That's what I'm saying, and that's. I hate seeing people try and figure out a workaround.
Right.
Like, if you say
the
I
same
can call,
people that when they were cops complained they
no
never
doubt
got training.
About it. And that's what, like, even on the DPA stuff, like the one group at Convention Center, it was we're going to try and hang out at the CVS's or whatever it was and try and grab these people that are doing. I do believe that there is an element to that. That is a training element on what we're going to do if this isn't in progress. We're going to be here and we're going to see X, Y, and Z. And the team worked on that too. And I think some sergeants kind of lose some sight on that. Well, I'm going to tell you what our training is going to be, and we're going to go do this. Well, I think you and Kevin are of the mindset that, listen, we're all trying to be a part of the buy-off. We're all trying to say, hey, the best plan is the one that everyone was a part of.
Right.
Because then I can't say this was stupid, because I actually had input. I actually had some say in what we're doing. So it irks us at the PPA when we do – you and I have these conversations or –
yeah, we're in agreement. And
then all of a sudden some captain doesn't tell a lieutenant how it's supposed to go, and the lieutenant's not – he's not doing anything wrong.
Well, just show them the MOU. The sheriff's signature's on the bottom of whatever agreement we have. So if they don't agree with it –
But, again, like I said, and like we talked about, and I won't say the air command, but the lieutenants are like, I've never seen this email about – and I'm like, gosh, like that's where the headaches get caused at our level –
right.
When in reality,
no one ever told me, right?
None of us had anything to do with it. It was like, goodness gracious, get the info out. We want, from the undersheriff's mouth, we want to have people training. We want them to stay proficient. We want them to be technical at what they do, whether it's handcuffing, whether it's defensive tactics, whether it's driving, right? I mean, we have a big issue with driving going on. We know that folks are blowing the speed limit like by 40, 50 miles an hour. Yeah. And listen, when we talk to our troops, we tell them, like, it wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
If you died... or if you killed someone, would it have been worth it? You know,
and some of those would be a great. Hey, what were you thinking? Right, and have him talk to the squad and go, here's what happened to me. I could feel it coming, but I couldn't stop.
Yeah,
it, right. It's that type of conversation that is good training. That
what we used to have up all the time. If you don't arrive, you can't assist.
Can't arrive, you can't assist.
And I don't see that anymore. But it's so damn true. If you're in a fight, and I drive beyond my means, and I roll a car, or I T-bone someone else.
Every resource has
potentially
to get
the closest body to you was me, and I'm out.
Right,
I'm not coming.
And now people that can come and help the first guy can't even know because they have to help you.
That's what I'm saying. You know, so it's like that thing we used to kind of joke about it. Don't arrive, can't assist.
Yeah.
But it's very true. If I can't get there, I can't help you out.
But even when in the cynicism or the sarcasm, sometimes that's okay.
Yeah,
because they they get it.
No doubt. I remember that to this day.
Well, like we used to play the Simply the Best video all the time. Now I hear people go, Simply the Best. And I'm like, here we go. Look, training saves lives, right? I mean, the reason the sheriff, myself, and other people that have been involved in this conversation is because we want to give our cops, when bad things are happening, we want to give our cops the best opportunity they can to go home to their families, to save lives, to protect this community. And the only way we're going to get there is we give them the reps, we give them the time, we give them the training, period.
Well, and it even goes a step further. I used to always be the proponent of, we go home at the end of the shift. And that's true. But as I was teaching the ICAT, the Integrating Communications Assessment and Tactics, one of the things that we teach in there is that the mindset is we all go home.
Right.
Listen, none of us want to take a life. If I can go 30 years without ever taking a life, I prefer that. We know officers that still live with the lives they've taken. Totally justified, but we're not built to take the lives of others. And so the truth is that sometimes our training not just saves ours, it saves theirs.
Sure.
It gets us to get them in custody quicker so we don't have to use lethal force or something. And so, you know, that mindset of making sure on a call everyone goes home is important. Even if the guy going to jail, I probably still don't want to take his life.
No, all our job. Our job is to always save lives, you know, and it's a key component of what we do. And you're right. A lot of that, I mean, how many incidents have we had with the advent of like the 40 millimeter low lethal to talk about de-escalation? I mean, we were talking offline about this incident involving the food vendor and our cop out there in South Central. Like, you know, and there were people that were critical of the lack of de-escalation. And I know where that situation would have gone 5-10 years ago.
Absolutely.
And look, can we look at that and learn from it? Absolutely. There are things we could have done better. Yeah. But folks were, I think we've gotten to the point where people are, you know, so happy with what we've done as an organization that they look at that and go, well, there needs to be more de-escalation. And I'm like, look, I look at that and go, look how far we've come. And you're right. And in that situation, you know, the officer thankfully wasn't injured. The citizen wasn't injured. So, you know, I think that's a win for all of us.
For sure.
So,
yeah. Well, I think we've monopolized the undersheriff's time enough. He's got
plenty
of grease fires to put out. We'll do another maybe December.
I'll come back. Am I going to be the first three time?
That's right. I don't know if we said that. He's the first repeat.
Yeah.
First repeat in all the episodes we've had. Yeah. And from the polls we've got from our many million, everyone has preferred you as the guest over anybody. So it should be a face that was made for radio too.
Not podcasts.
A lot of listen. We get a lot of messages about, you know, is he single? He's a good looking man. And then I tell Yant, stop sending those messages. I'm tired of it. So, we appreciate you, Andy.
I'll say this. This is a great platform for, you know, I'm a picture on a wall in a substation. You know what I mean? I'm a picture on an org chart. I get that. And, for me to have this kind of conversation and, you know, I think it's not just an opportunity for people outside of law enforcement, you know, to see, me, but it's a chance for our cops who are dads and moms and, you know, parents, you know, I'm just as human as everybody else. I've been doing this a little bit longer. I've been fortunate to be promoted, but, you know, there's nothing special about it. It's just a work ethic and work hard and care. If you do that, then anything's possible. And I tell Emma every day, you know, work as hard as the hardest worker. And if you do that, not everything's going to be perfect, but it's a great opportunity though, I think, for our young people on the police department to see that, you know, nothing changes. Like my role and my responsibilities have changed over the years. The things I have to make decisions about have changed over the years. But deep down inside, you know, I'm a husband, I'm a father. I care about those things first and foremost. And I give a lot of my heart and soul to this organization while trying to keep all that straight and in line. And, They can do it too. That's the whole message, is they can do it too. And whatever your goals and dreams are, you can exceed your wildest dreams like I have. I thought I was going to retire a sergeant, and I don't want to pontificate too much longer, but I'm grateful. When you ask, I jump. I say, absolutely, this just a way to connect with, you know, there were up to 23 million viewers.
Yeah,
now. No. So
you left off a few zeros.
I can't see that far. So
that's true. That happens.
But no, that's always grateful to be able to come on. And I know the next guy's coming on too. That's congratulations to you guys for hitting your 25 years, and you've all had a phenomenal impact. And you know, Reggie's gonna—you can tell Reggie I picked Fred, and
I will. He's gonna cry. That was what this was tailor made for.
For Reggie, me to tee up Reggie.
No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, we appreciate it, Andy. Okay, so we'll take a quick break. We'll bring in our next three guests, my cohorts from Cadet Academy from 8 of 98.
What was the class number? Two of three? What was the?
We were just one of the cadets are just one of 98.
One of 98.
You know, because you guys were
two of 98.
Two, right? Yeah, because we didn't run 18 academies a year like we try and do now. But yeah, so thanks, Andy. Appreciate you, buddy. We'll talk to you around Christmas time. 111, 110.